Welcome to the Earth First Update, bringing you all the environmental news you need to know for over 20 years. I'm Uncle Dennis here in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM and www.freakradio.org on Thursday, November 30th, 2017. I want to ask you to please have a pencil and paper handy so you can take down the names, addresses, emails, web pages, and phone numbers so you can take action for the environment. Let's start with announcements. The California Native Plant Society Habitat Restoration Team will be having a restoration this Saturday, December 2nd, from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. at Seabright Beach State Park, just across the street from the City Museum. We will join groundswell coastal ecology staff and volunteers in removing the last large patch of ice plant in the Seabright Cove in preparation for planting of native plants this winter. This is exciting as we are adding to the immensely successful restoration work at Seabright Beach. This is the largest coastal restoration in the city of Santa Cruz. Bring your muscle. We will provide tools, coffee, and bagels. The Habitat Restoration Project at Seabright State Beach has been ongoing for 3 or 4 years now. The project is spearheaded by Groundswell Coastal Ecology in partnership with the California State Parks. Volunteers have pulled tons of non-native vegetation, primarily ice plant, and planted many thousands of natives. These plants are coastal strand and coastal scrub species propagated from locally collected seeds. The plants have grown rapidly into a gorgeous habitat and the additional reward of a steady increase of pollinators and birds. How to get there? Well, the meeting spot is at the entrance of Seabright Beach, part of Twin Lakes State Beach on the west side of the Yacht Harbor. From the intersection of Highway 17, take Ocean Street down till it ends and turn left. You have the river on your right and the beach boardwalk beyond that. Go up the hill, and shortly after passing the train trestle, make a quick right-hand turn. Follow this down towards the ocean, and we'll curve to the left and start going down a hill across from the Santa Cruz Museum of Natural History, where a large gray whale sculpture is present. The bottom of the hill is the entrance to Seabright Beach, where we will meet up. Seabright Beach has no parking lot, but you can park anywhere in the neighborhood streets as there is not a no parking sign or a red curb. There is no neighborhood parking permit required in the area. Once again, this Saturday, December 2nd, 2017, from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. at Seabright Beach State Park. The Santa Cruz Native Plant Society Habitat Restoration Team is an all-volunteer group working to restore native habitat in the parks and protected lands in Santa Cruz County. Their program provides an opportunity for people to learn about the natural systems that surround them while helping you restore special and wild places. No prior work experience is necessary. Just show up at the park. They welcome individual volunteers from 8 to 80. Please wear comfortable, layered clothing, bring something to drink, and lots of enthusiasm. They work rain or shine, but if things get particularly unpleasant, they'll call it a day. There's a very slight chance of rain on Saturday, but it'll probably be nice. Remember that tools are provided, so bring your gloves and water. If you have more questions, contact Linda, the program leader, at 831-462-4041. That's 831-462-4041. By email at redwoodrn, that's redwdrn, at pacbell.net, or go to their website at www.cruzcnps.org. That's cruzcnps.org. And volunteer with the Buffalo Field Campaign. Come stand with the last wild buffalo. Come join the Buffalo Field Campaign on their front lines. You could be in the field with the country's last wild buffalo, documenting both the good and the horrible that goes on in their everyday lives, helping us to share with the world what is taking place so that we can stop it. Volunteering your time and energy is both fulfilling and what the buffalo absolutely need. You could be skiing, snowshoeing, or hiking in the field, or help out in the office at base camp to make sure that the people on patrol are safe, help out in the kitchen to keep everyone fed and full of energy. Our field season runs until June, when buffalo are migrating into Montana and into a dangerous conflict zone. We run patrols in both the Hebgen Basin and the Gardner Basin, west and north of Yellowstone National Park. Morning, afternoon, and sometimes evening patrols are conducted in the Hebgen Basin, while we do week-long shifts in the Gardner Basin, where buffalo are in the most trouble. If you want more information about volunteering, please go to the webpage www.buffalofieldcampaign.org, where you can find out more information, or you could call area code 406-646-0070. That's 406-646-0070. And the Mattole Forest Defenders need your help in this story from the Mattole Ancient Forest Campaign, as found in the Earth First Newswire. If you read the Earth First Journal, the Earth First Newswire, or the Earth First Newsletter, or listened to Earth First Radio over the past decade or so, you surely heard about the fight to protect the Mattole Forest. If reading about the trees, wild animals, and forest defenders risking their lives to protect them makes you itch to head west, well, now's your chance. A few weeks ago, allies in the Mattole Valley obtained written assurances from Humboldt Redwood Company will not try to log, build roads, or spray herbicides in the Long Ridge area until next year. Consequently, the forest defenders have removed the blockade and shifted attention to shoring up the defenses in other ways, like community outreach, organizing trainings, gathering data in the field to fight the company's misinformation campaign, and much more. This summer, the forest defenders mistakenly believed that logging pits permits would begin expiring this year, 5 years after they have been approved. However, it turns out the permits can last for 7 years now, which means that the forest could remain under imminent threat until 2021, unless there is some kind of resolution. All the more reason for you to quit your job, abandon your lease, and head to the woods. Preparations for next year will begin with a training camp in early January. It's still in the preliminary planning stages, so we will announce the date and location once we've decided, but you can play a part in helping to make that happen. The Save Mattole Ancient Forest Campaign are putting out a call for passionate earth lovers who are ready to join us on the front lines this winter and the rest of next year if need be. If you want more info or get in touch, please go to contactefhum@gmail.com. That's contactefhum@gmail.com. And the urgent appeal from Sea Shepherd Conservation is going out. Jeff Hansen, Managing Director of Sea Shepherd Australia, has stated, "The Steve Irwin vessel has defended Antarctica for over a decade, protected whales off the Kimberley coast and the Great Australian Bight, and it has also facilitated the shutting down of the Interpol Wanted Bandit 6 toothfish poachers operating in the Southern Ocean and 6 illegal drift net vessels operating in the South Indian Ocean. To continue its relentless fight for the ocean, Sea Shepherd's flagship, the motor yacht Steve Irwin, definitely needs Australia's and your help. This warhorse for the oceans is currently getting an engine overhaul, and the work has stalled due to a lack of funds, and Sea Shepherd is calling on all peoples of the world to please dig deep to get the Irwin back out on the sea once again. Up-and-coming campaigns include the defense of the Great Barrier Reef from the Adani coal mine, continued protection of the Great Australian Bight, as well as future marine conservation work," said Mr. Hansen. "Sea Shepherd Conservation Society is incredibly lean and effective. We are only a handful of staff globally, coordinating an army of volunteers and campaigns and a fleet of 9 ships. The motor yacht Steve Irwin has to lead the charge for 10 years, but ships are expensive and we really rely on the public support to keep our ships out at sea. If we can't complete the engine overhaul, the Irwin will not be fit for sea and our operations will be severely hindered," concluded Mr. Hansen. If you want to support this engine refit, go to www.seashepherd.org.au/SOS. That's www.seashepherd.org.au/SOS. And a lawsuit seeks to block California Desert Water Project in this story by Robert Jablon of the Associated Press, as found in the Washington Post. Environmental activists sued Tuesday to halt the plan to pump water from beneath the Mojave Desert and sell it to Southern California cities and counties. The lawsuit takes aim at the U.S. Bureau of Land Management for allowing Cadiz Incorporated to build a 43-mile pipeline to transfer water from its desert wells in the Colorado River Aqueduct so it can be sold to water districts. The BLM released guidelines during the Obama administration to block construction of the pipeline along an existing federal railroad right-of-way, but the Trump administration reversed them this year, and the project is on a priority infrastructure list. A lawsuit says the new guidelines would illegally permit construction of the pipeline on public land, including the newly created Mojave Trails National Monument, while circumventing laws enacted to protect human health and the environment. According to the suit, Cadiz could drop perhaps billions of gallons of water from fragile desert aquifers, far more than could be replenished naturally, and that would dry up streams that are important for plants and wildlife and create dry lake beds that would produce wind-blown dust pollution. The suit also contends that the underground water contains cancer-causing chemicals and other toxins such as mercury. The Cadiz project will suck the desert dry while developers count their money, said Eileen Anderson, a senior scientist with the Center for Biological Diversity, which filed the suit along with the Center for Food Safety. It's an unsustainable water privatization scheme. The BLM ruled in October that Cadiz could use the current railroad right-of-way rather than having to seek approval through a process that would include public comment and a review, the suit said. The BLM had not reviewed the complaint and could not comment, spokeswoman Sarah K. Webster said in a statement. Cadiz called the allegations about water quality and intentionally misleading state permissions for the project to continue. Specifically, it would have required two additional state agencies to determine whether the project would harm natural and cultural resources. And here's the update from the Buffalo Field Campaign. Unseasonably warm temperatures persist in the last of the wild land of the last wild buffalo, and there is very little snow. Hebgen Lake remains unfrozen and mud is being tracked everywhere. The open ground has enabled buffalo to continue easier grazing at higher altitudes within the boundaries of Yellowstone, and so far, the Gardner Basin along the park's northern boundary also remains quiet. In the Hebgen Basin west of Yellowstone, buffalo are on the move. With so little snow, travel has been easy for them and grass still accessible. Hunters continue to respond to the messages left on bison hunt hotlines and arrive en masse when they are given the green light for easy pickings. Imagine a hunt where all you have to do is pick up the phone and have someone tell you exactly where your prey is. Then all you have to do is get your truck and drive to that spot. If the buffalo are in a safe zone, even if it's a neighborhood full of houses, no problem. Just wait in the heated cab until they cross an imaginary line, then get out of your warm truck and fire your weapon. That's what Montana's buffalo hunt looks like. But the buffalo have been through this many times before, and they are getting smarter all the time. Since our last update, nearly 200 buffalo were outside of park boundaries in the Hebgen Basin. Two of them were shot and killed by hunters. The rest either moved back into the relative safety of the park or into buffalo-friendly private land where they are safe. But that doesn't stop the hunters from stalking them in neighborhoods and along Yellowstone's boundary. The fact that the central herd has been mismanaged to the point of such serious declines that hunting closures are being recommended by biologists doesn't stop them either, nor does it stop those same biologists from intending to carry on with their massive slaughter plans this winter. The Buffalo Field Campaign attended and represented at Tuesday's Interagency Bison Management Plan meeting. The status of the central herd was not even on the agenda, but Buffalo Field Campaign made sure that this serious issue would not be ignored. We issued a press release and hand-delivered a letter about the status of the central herd, calling for not only a hunting ceasefire in the Hebgen Basin, where only buffalo from the central herd might migrate, but also for a moratorium on Yellowstone's capture for any reason. By recommending a hunting closure west of the park, Yellowstone is attempting to place a conservation burden solely on hunters, yet their unnecessary and indiscriminate capture for slaughter far exceeds the number of buffalo killed by hunters in both the Hebgen and Gardner basins combined. And they know that central herd buffalo migrate north into the Gardner Basin, where Yellowstone National Park rangers and biologists run their nefarious trap, shipping hundreds of north and central herd buffalo to slaughter. But aside from a few radio-collared females, they have no idea which herd or family groups which buffalo come from. In other words, it is utterly negligent and irresponsible for Yellowstone to place the onus on hunters while they carry on with their slaughter plans. Everyone who takes from the buffalo needs to heed the warnings and do their part to end the bloodlust. The California Department of Fish and Wildlife has awarded $1.3 million for the restoration of watersheds impacted by cannabis cultivation. The California Department of Fish and Wildlife has announced the selection of four projects to receive funding for habitat restoration projects within California's northern coastal watersheds most impacted by unregulated cannabis cultivation. The awards totaling $1.3 million were made under CDFW's Cannabis Restoration Grant Program and will support the cleanup and habitat restoration at inactive cannabis cultivation sites. These grants mark an important step towards our efforts to address the extensive damage to habitat and toxic chemicals threatening a host of wild species, CDFW Director Charlton A. Bonham said. Providing a resource to address the impacts of reckless cannabis cultivation adds an important piece to the complex puzzle of our existing watershed restoration work. Projects approved for funding through the Cannabis Restoration Grant Program include reclaiming our public lands and watersheds from the environmental threats called by trespass cannabis cultivation, the Bull Creek Cannabis Recovery Project, the Southern Usal Creek Headwaters, and Whitethorn Grove Cleanup. Projects funded under the 2017 Cannabis Restoration Program are scheduled to commence in early 2018. The Cannabis Restoration Grant Program was established by CDFW in 2017 in response to legislation aimed at regulating the burgeoning legal cannabis industry. In his signing message to Assembly Bill 243, Governor Brown directed the Natural Resources Agency to identify projects to begin the restoration of our most impacted areas in the state. And a legal notice pushes the United States to embargo Mexican seafood caught with vaquita porpoise-killing nets in this story from the Center for Biological Diversity. Conservation groups filed a legal notice today pressing the U.S. government to ban seafood caught in Mexico's upper Gulf of California in an effort to save the last remaining vaquita porpoises. The main threat to the vaquita's survival is drowning after getting caught in gill nets used for fishing. The Natural Resources Defense Council, Animal Welfare Institute, and Center for Biological Diversity notified the U.S. National Marine Fisheries Service that its failure to ban imports of seafood from the vaquitas habitat in Mexico violates the Marine Mammal Protection Act. The Marine Mammal Protection Act requires the U.S. government to ban seafood imports from fisheries that kill marine mammals like the vaquita in excess of U.S. standards for marine mammal bycatch, which is the accidental entanglement and death of marine mammals in fishing gear. Given the vaquita's gravely imperiled status, if U.S. standards were applied to Mexican fishermen operating in or near the vaquita's habitat, they would be prohibited from contributing to the bycatch of any vaquita. With far fewer than 30 remaining vaquitas and an annual decline rate of nearly 50%, this species is the most endangered cetacean and one of the most endangered animals on the planet. The animals will be at grave risk during the next expected uptake of intensive totoaba poaching from January to March 2018. Mexico's government has been absolutely complicit in managing the demise of the vaquita, said Zach Smith, a senior attorney for the NRDC's Marine Mammal Protection Project. Gillnet fishing has been driving the vaquita's extinction for decades. Even today, fishing vessels and active gillnets are being found in restricted areas, but the government refuses to take the necessary steps for the vaquitas to survive, ensuring a 100% gill-free habitat 100% of the time. It's the only way to save them. A recent capture and conserve plan sought to buy more time for the vaquita, but it failed. Now the only hope of keeping the vaquita, one of only six porpoise species, from going extinct within the next 4 months is to immediately render their habitat free of gill nets. And environmentalists have sued the Forest Service to overturn the Rosemont mine approval. Four environmental groups sued the U.S. Forest Service recently, charging that its approval of the proposed Rosemont mine violated 10 environmental laws and seek to have the approval overturned. The 75-page lawsuit filed in U.S. District Court directly challenges the service's statement in its June decision approving the mine that it won't violate environmental laws. The Forest Service has long stated that it can't say no to the mine as long as it meets all applicable federal laws and regulations. Coronado Forest Supervisor Kerwin Dewberry declined to comment on the suit Monday, saying the agency typically doesn't comment on pending litigation except in formal legal responses. The suit alleged that the mine will violate various water laws and standards, for instance, reducing the flows to Cienega Creek and its tributary Empire Gulch. The suit also warns of water quality violations due to mine discharges of pollutants such as arsenic, iron, and mercury into Barrel Canyon, a tributary to Davidson Canyon, which in turn flows into Cienega Creek. The suit also says the Forest Service is legally wrong in saying that it can't stop the mine due to a host of laws dating back to the 1872 Mining Act. The service says those laws essentially provide a right for people and companies to mine resources from federal lands as long as they meet environmental laws and rules. But the lawsuit says these rules only apply when a mining company shows it has filed violent mining claims to the federal land. Such claims are only valid if the company has shown publicly that it can mine the area's copper at a profit, which the suit says it hasn't done. The suit was filed by the Tucson-based Save the Scenic Santa Ritas and the Center for Biological Diversity, the Sierra Club's Grand Canyon chapter, and the Arizona Mining Reform Coalition. And a UCB study finds that family-friendly overpasses are needed to save grizzly bears, and UCBC is the University of British Columbia. Researchers have determined how female grizzly bears keep their cubs safe while crossing the Trans-Canadian Highway. Adam Ford, Canada Research Chair in Wildlife Restoration Ecology at UBC's Okanagan campus, along with Montana State University's Tony Clevinger, studied the travel patterns of grizzlies in Banff National Park between 1997 and 2014. In most cases, a mother bear traveled with cubs opted to use a wildlife overpass instead of a tunnel to cross the highway. We used data from Canada's longest and most detailed study of road-wildlife interactions, explained Ford, an assistant professor of biology. We found that grizzly bear females and cubs prefer to use overpasses rather to cross the highway. During the 17-year study period, bears not traveling in these family groups used both the overpasses and the underpasses. And we thank the Environmental News Network for that story. And albatrosses are in decline from fishing and environmental challenge. The population of wandering black-browed and gray-headed albatrosses have halved over the past 35 years on sub-Antarctic Bird Island, according to a new study published in the Journal of Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. The research, led by scientists at British Antarctic Studies, attributes this decline to environmental change and to the death of longline and trawl fisheries, also known as bycatch. Albatrosses are the world's most threatened family of birds. There are 22 species, according to the IUCN Red List. 17 of these are threatened with extinction, and the remaining 5 are considered to be near threatened. BAS scientists at Bird Island have been monitoring the population since 1972, and again, we thank the Environmental News Network for that story. And the U.S. has just revealed its recovery plan for Mexican gray wolves in this story by Noel Kirkpatrick of MNN News. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service released its Mexican wolf recovery plan with the goal to average 320 wolves in New Mexico and Arizona over an 8-year period. Over the last 3 years of the period, the population would have to exceed that average to ensure that it doesn't backslide. Once the goal is met, the wolf will be considered to be declassified as an endangered species. Currently, there are 113 Mexican gray wolves in Arizona and New Mexico. Another 30 to 35 wolves are accounted for in Mexico itself. Conservation are using, among other methods, artificial insemination to boost the population and to genetically diversify it, a key to developing healthy and more viable pups. The recovery plan projects that these numbers would grow to 145 in the U.S. and 100 in Mexico over the next 5 years. This plan really provides us a roadmap where we need to go to get this species recovered and delisted and to get its management turned back over to the states and tribes, Sherry Barrett, the Mexican Wolf Recovery Coordinator, told the Associated Press. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service weighed comments about the wolves' recovery from lawmakers and state officials, environmentalists, scientists, and business owners to create the plan. Barrett told the AP that the final plan's scientific models were reviewed by wildlife officials and other peers in an effort to protect the wolves' genetic diversity. The plan calls for targeted releases from captive bred wolves. Improvements in the wolves' survival rates will be a factor in just how many releases are needed. While the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has final say in the matter regarding the releases, wildlife officials in New Mexico and Arizona will have influence regarding the timing and location that these captive bred wolves are released into the wild. The Center for Biological Diversity called the plan deeply flawed and criticized it for doing too little to protect the wolves. This isn't a recovery plan, it's a blueprint for disaster for Mexican gray wolves, said Michael Robinson, a conservation advocate at the Center for Biological Diversity. By limiting their habitat and stripping protections too soon, the plan ignores the science and ensures Mexican wolves never reach sufficient numbers to be secure. The center references a 2011 plan presented to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service that called for three interconnected populations with a total of 750 animals as a more realistic number for survival than the 320 listed in the released plan. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for the Earth First Update this week. The Earth First Update is presented every Thursday evening at 9 o'clock right here on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM and www.freakradio.org. You can listen to a rebroadcast tomorrow afternoon. That's Fridays at 3 p.m. as part of our Environment Friday programming. You could also listen to WMNB 107.1 in North Adams, Massachusetts, Fridays at 5:30 in the morning, KRFP 90.3 Moscow, Idaho, Wednesdays at 3 p.m., KOWA 106.5 in Olympia, Washington, Saturdays at 7 a.m., WLSL 92.7 in Dade City, Florida, Sundays at noon. You could also listen to KHCF 89.9 in Morgan Hill, Gilroy, California, KGIG 104.9 in Modesto, California, KPHD 93.3 also in Modesto, California, or Berkeley Liberation Radio 104.1 in Berkeley, California. All of these stations rebroadcast the Earth First Update. Check their website for times and days. You could also listen to the Grateful Dead Public Radio online, that's gdprnashville.org, Sundays at 2 a.m. Once again, gdprnashville.org. And you can always go to radioforall.net, that's radio, the number, for all.net, where you can listen online or download this or previous shows anytime you want to. And please ask your local nonprofit community radio station to air the Earth First Update every week. It is free to download and broadcast. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio and produced at the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. I'm Uncle Dennis. I want to thank you for listening, and please do tune in next week for another edition of the Earth First Update.